Bishop Graham, thank you very much for your welcome, and thank you all for the invitation to be here with you this evening, and indeed just for turning up. It's always a joy to be in Norfolk, not least in this part where my family have had many very happy holidays over the years, and indeed many very happy pilgrimages to a little place just down the road at Walsingham. But to have the opportunity of thinking out loud with you for a bit about the rural church and the rural experience has been for me a real stimulus and opportunity to put ideas together, which I hope are relevant not just to thinking about rural society, but perhaps a little bit to our society as a whole. Bishop Graham mentioned a few minutes ago the way I didn't run the Church of England, but one of the things that an Archbishop of Canterbury cannot avoid being involved in is the process of nominating bishops to the Prime Minister and the Crown. And quite often, in the Crown Nominations Commission, somebody will say about this diocese or that, well, we're looking for somebody who has rural experience. And we then go into a very, very long and sometimes slightly bad-tempered discussion about what rural experience is. Because in this country, the reality of non-urban life is astonishingly varied. Within the United Kingdom, rural can mean the hill farms that my fellow countryman R.S. Thomas writes about in his poems. It can mean the Cotswolds and the picture book and chocolate box countryside that's so popular in parts of the national imagination. It can mean commuters in Ashford. It can mean agribusiness in East Anglia. It can mean the seasonal poverty of a tourist-dominated economy in Cornwall or the Lake District. And even within one county like this, it can mean a wide variety of realities which you know better than I do. Is there anything that all these varieties of non-urban life have in common? I want to begin what I have to say this evening by thinking out loud a bit about that question. What do they have in common? Sadly, the first thing that they seem to have in common when we begin to reflect on this is a series of absences, things that aren't there. Public transport, for example. Concentrated retail outlets. And that means, of course, that rural life, in contrast to the fantasies of some people, is not ever these days simply a matter of sitting in one place forever. Rural life is remarkably mobile. It involves budgeting for travel in all kinds of ways. Travel to shop, travel for medical services, and very often, of course, for farming communities, the routine travel involved in that. And that's before we even begin to think about the lives of commuters in some bits of supposedly rural England. It's quite important to remember that, because the language about the countryside as timeless and static is still very deeply ingrained in some people's minds. And while I think I see what that means, whenever I've been in rural environments, the words timeless and static have actually not been the words uppermost in my mind. Some of you will remember a speech by John Major about the essence of English identity, which had to do with warm beer and the sound of bats and balls on a summer evening and spinsters cycling to Holy Communion through the early morning mists. It was a catalogue which he derived from an essay by George Orwell some 50 years earlier. And it does, of course, sum up the mythology that surrounds rural experience in lots of people's minds. But in fact, even 50 years before John Major, it was a rather slanted and partial picture of the countryside. It took for granted that image of something unchanging, something which in a way took us right out of the stresses, changes and choices of modern life. And the first point I want to make, tentatively, because you know more about rural experience than I do, is that I really don't think it's helpful to see the countryside as timeless in that way. The countryside, as we're often reminded, is partly a human creation. Generations and generations of labour, of real involvement, wrestling with the environment, have made the countryside what it is. We are not Stone Age peasants huddling in huts surrounded by untamed nature. Rural life is life which reflects a long history of, could we dare to say, humanizing the environment around us. And that, of course, is one of the things that is sometimes forgotten when people speak about rural experience, especially about farming life. The aspect of what I can only call the custodianship of a farming community in the countryside. They have transformed a landscape, made it their own, and that is part of the legacy we all share. Ignore that part, that aspect of rural life and especially farming life, and you ignore something really central and really significant in the life of the wider national community. But I suppose what is true in a way about that rather romanticized picture of the countryside is that there is always in rural experience that element of having to wrestle with what's there, to deal with, to engage with what is given. You don't choose the soil, you don't choose the landscape, and above all, you don't choose the weather. That the countryside is the result of generations of engagement, creative involvement with a landscape, means quite simply that human skill, human labour, human imagination have been caught up in trying to make something out of an environment which pushes back, which resists, which is difficult, stimulating, and sometimes intensely frustrating, whether it's landscape, soil, or weather that we're speaking of. It means that the human experience in the rural environment is never going to be one in which the human will, human choices, are completely in charge, and it's never going to be one in which one place is exchangeable with another. The particularities of landscape and soil and weather mean that what rural life is like in Norfolk is not what rural life is like in Carmarthenshire. Back to where I started. Rural is a hugely varied term because landscape and soil and weather are different. And rural experience means you can't avoid the sense of particularity, being here rather than somewhere else. One of the great sadnesses, I think, of an age of mass communication, though I don't think it's reversible, is that we all increasingly are drifting towards speaking the same kind of English. And the erosion of dialect as part of the distinctive local identity does seem to me rather sad. In brackets, when we first moved to Wales, my wife bravely and generously decided she needed to learn a bit of Welsh and started going to Welsh evening classes. She used to bring her exercises home and ask me for advice on them, and I was totally unhelpful, because when she came up with the textbook answers, I would often say, "Nobody talks like that." Because, of course, the Welsh I learned was the Welsh of 20-odd square miles on the border of Glamorgan and Carmarthenshire, where what you called a kettle, what you called a gate in a field, was completely unintelligible to somebody who came from Montgomeryshire or Pembrokeshire. I do rather regret the passing of that world, but in Wales, as in England, it is passing. And sorry, another personal reminiscence about that, but I can remember once listening to an announcer on Welsh television, speaking Welsh, and trying quite unsuccessfully to decide where she came from. I couldn't make it out, and I happened to meet her a year or so after this and asked where she came from, and she said London. She had learned Welsh in night school. A terrible warning. But let me get back to the main point. Life in the country is never going to be life that is nowhere in particular. And one of the problems that the modern urban experience faces is the question of what it does to the human mind and imagination to live nowhere in particular. I used to know a very eccentric Canadian sculptor who argued that airports were a systematic attempt by those in authority to prepare us for living in outer space. Because he said, an airport is the supreme example of being nowhere in particular. And because there's no landscape in outer space, as far as we can see, that's how we get ready for it. But rural experience involves that dialogue between what's there, what's given, and the needs and skills of human communities and human individuals. A dialogue which, like every dialogue, produces something utterly distinctive and utterly different in every context. What's given is different, and the needs and the skills are different as well. The landscape matters, and the weather and the soil matter. So, is it right to say that rural experience is about human interdependence, recognizing that the human world is not just one that we've made up, but one that we've worked out in dialogue? Human experience is not just human beings deciding, this is what we're going to be, this is how we're going to exist, and driving on with that agenda. No, human experience is about pushing and being pushed at, giving and receiving, feeling, molding, sensing, proposing, a dialogue. And there's something about the essence of being human contained in that, which certain kinds of modern urban experience encourage us simply to forget. Rural experience deflates some of our more extravagant expectations around human power and human control. The weather and the soil mark the inescapable physical dimension of being human. You can't suppose that you're just a mind or a will or a fancy floating in midair. And the way in which urban experience is so consistently put before us as the norm for all real, serious human experience, in the media, often in our fantasies, in the imaginative images put before us, that can mislead and even corrupt our sense of what is genuinely human. I'm talking, of course, about the experience of prosperous urban life. Because, of course, the experience of the urban poor is an experience of even greater helplessness and powerlessness than that of those in a rural environment. They, at least as much as anyone in the countryside, have to negotiate their own freedom in relation to what is often very brutally and inhumanly given environment. But I'm speaking about the way in which a highly metropolitan media, a very metropolitan and cosmopolitan sense of what is an appropriate, achievable lifestyle, how these constantly reinforce in us the feeling that real, grown-up, contemporary humanity is about choice and control. And because in rural life, choice and control are never going to be everything, rural life has something to say that is really rather important for our humanity's good. I was speaking the other day to someone who was expressing an increasing concern about the way in which electronic communication pushed us further and further away from face-to-face relation. To the extent that in some electronic contexts, people seem to believe, genuinely to believe, that their real identity is what they construct through that medium, rather than their own embodied reality, vulnerable and local. We do, I think, have some real cultural questions there, which perhaps we're not thinking seriously enough about at the moment. Well, so far I've spoken in rather general terms about rural experience, and I haven't spoken very much about Christianity and the rural church. And I want now to move on to reflecting a bit on what Christianity seems to say about the rural and urban reality of human life. One of the great slogans that's sometimes been used about the Bible is that it is a story which begins in a garden and ends in a city. I think that's a very important half-truth. The garden where things begin is, of course, a garden in which the experience I've just been talking about hasn't yet begun, the experience of real creative engagement and struggle. And the city where the story ends is remarkably unlike some of the modern metropolises that we think about. It has, for example, a very considerable river running down the middle of it with trees by the side. It also has at its centre a mystery, the city of God in the Revelation of John. The city of God is centred on the temple, the new temple, which is the person of the Lamb of God. So far from this city being a place where every individual's choice and control is privileged, everything in this city flows to and from the mystery which makes us human, the sacrificed Lamb, the Saviour, the one with whom we all have to find our way to be human, because if we try to go by any other route, we shall end up being less than human, the way, the truth, and the life. This is a city in sharp contrast to the typical modern city, because at its heart is what we can never manage and never control, the mystery of God's love. In dialogue with that mystery, we become human. It's as if the city that comes at the end of the Bible story is a city which has embraced what is most significant in the rural experience, becoming human in dialogue with what is mysterious, strange, uncontrollable, sometimes beautiful, and often terrifying. That element of the rural experience is carried over into the vision of the city of God, so that we cannot say that the city of God is a city like the average metropolis of late modernity. A place, on the one hand, dominated by technological wizardry and control, and on the other hand, living with an immense surplus human population of powerless and forgotten people. this is a city where every eye is drawn towards a mystery which creates community. Something of what is learned in the rural experience, in other words, is there at the heart of that ultimate, creative, redeemed community which stands at the end of the Bible story. And the worst fate for any city would be to be sealed off in its own fantasies about technology and control, wealth and security. So in our contemporary society, I'm suggesting, the rural experience has something profoundly challenging, disturbing and necessary to say to the whole experience of our culture. And the rural church, to come at last to that central topic for tonight's reflections, the rural church is, among other things, and I'll come to some of the other things in a bit, among other things, a sign of the rural community being aware of itself. The rural church is there, among many other things, to remind people what the human experience is like in this place, in this time. And that works in at least three ways. The rural church speaks of the past. It speaks of the cumulative heritage of art and imagery and skill. It speaks of people's engagement with both nature in the materials that it uses, the wonderful presence in so many churches across our country of local material built into, sanctified by the church building, an engagement also with faith. It speaks of the images of an integrated or healed life that emerge from that engagement with the mystery of a world around. It speaks of the past, all of that legacy of skill and imagination, born of the experience of local wrestling and engagement with the mysteriousness and the uncontrollability of the environment, all of that held physically in this building. Second, as you will be reminded if you look out of the window, it speaks of death. It speaks of the fact that human beings come and go in this place. It speaks of limits, frailty, ends, the passage of time. It tells us that death is both tragic and normal, that there is no way of living humanly that doesn't at some point and at some level have to come to terms with the fact that we die and that that is, so to speak, all right. Death is here, recognized, visible, faced, not simply feared, made something of, faced and understood a bit, but part of a human imaginative landscape. And the rural church speaks, thirdly, of solidarity, of belonging. The fact that the community of any one place is not just the people who happen to be there at any one moment. Somehow who we are and what we are is bound up with far more than we can see, understand, or even imagine. History, death, belonging. Great, somber, significant facts about humanity. And here they are, encoded in this building and what lies around it. A reminder, at the very least, of humanity. Creative, mortal, involved with each other, triumphing in imagination, defeated in death, present still. That in itself, I would dare to say, is quite an agenda for the local church to carry as a building and as a community. The calling to represent in this locality, but also more widely in society, those great facts about our humanity. We have a past. We face a death. We belong with one another. That in itself is the beginning of a gospel. But that alone perhaps doesn't amount to very much more than the sort of thing that Philip Larkin wrote about in his famous poem on churchgoing. The sense of seriousness, being in a serious place, on serious ground, with the dead lying around. It's not quite enough as an account of what the rural church is about. There may be, one can imagine it, there could have been other signs of history and death and belonging. But the rural church is more than that. It's at least all that, and that's a lot. But it's more. This building, the focus of those reflections on time and death and solidarity, this building is also a building that houses something. It houses a table where God, made human, eats with us. It houses a sign of a God who is so hospitable, so welcoming to what he has made, that he meets us at our level and speaks to us in our language. This building houses a story, a human story, which is also God's. The story of how God, the infinite, beyond all place and time, how God has made his own place and time and words. How God has made himself accessible and makes himself accessible day after day in the memory and the reenactment of the story of his time with us in Jesus of Nazareth. And that table and that cross tell us what we need to know about the reality that frames all of our thoughts about history and death and solidarity. That tells us that the history of human beings is in the hand of love, that the death of human beings opens out onto resurrection, and that the solidarity and belonging together of human beings is finally a belonging with God himself. So those three themes may be great and wonderful in themselves, but housed here, housed in the presence of the table and the cross, they are immeasurably greater and immeasurably more promising. They tell us that the final truth about human beings is indeed not and nowhere in particular, but a real rootedness in a world whose reality has been embraced by God in all its physical, particular truth. In conclusion, then, I've been suggesting that at level one, rural experience generally has an essential word for urban experience and for our culture more widely. An obstinate and perhaps rather annoying reminder that we're not ultimately in charge of things like soil and weather, that we are discovering our humanity in dialogue with the world around us, not just imposing an agenda. Level one. At level two, all of that comes to be much more visible, much more clearly expressed in this building, which embodies a history and which embodies the facts of the passage of time and the reality of death, and which also opens our imagination out onto the mysterious, distant depths of the community we belong to without realizing it. But at level three, this is a building that not only embodies all those facts about human experience as it's lived out very particularly in the rural setting, it houses the memorials of the story of God's love holding us where we are as we are, body and spirit, local and universal, limited and creative, all of that together. If rural experience has an essential word for urban experience, the rural Christian experience, and the experience of the historic church, has still more to say. A word to say on behalf of a particular kind of humanity, which I hope is the kind of humanity we really want to see spread around the place these days. A humanity conscious of being created and mortal, and conscious also of being loved and stretched and changed, as opposed to a humanity, that fictional humanity, which sadly so much of our culture seems to be in love with, the humanity that's in charge, the humanity that seeks greater and greater control and greater independence and greater freedom to live nowhere in particular. To that, this place and what it stands for speak a word on behalf of what we can only call wisdom. Wisdom, remember, in the Old Testament is not just abstract good advice. Wisdom is God's gift in the world of the clues, the pathways, which connect us to one another and to God's own creative imagination and transfiguring love. Wisdom has built herself a house, is one of the great images in the book of Proverbs. And perhaps when we come into a church like this, that phrase could be in our minds. This is a house wisdom has built. And those who frequent this house are called on to be wise in their generation, as against the folly of an abstract and deluded and saddened and diminished humanity. Thank you.